Molly Knight has joined us on Sports Byline. We're talking about her book, The Best Team Money Can Buy, The Los Angeles Dodgers' Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse. What was the most significant move the Dodgers made after they bought the team?
Well, I would say the trade with the Red Sox to get Adrian Gonzalez and Josh Beckett and Carl Crawford, and not to forget Nick Punto also. That trade had enormous implications, not only for the Dodgers but for the Red Sox. I mean, the Red Sox went on the next year to win the World Series because of it. So it totally reshaped both organizations, and I think it worked out for LA too. They got Gonzalez. They needed that. He's been huge for their. They have an enormous Hispanic and Latino fan base, and so he's been huge as a Mexican American, you know, pillar of the community kind of guy. And they also just kind of put the world on notice that, like, yeah, this group is going to spend money unlike any team we've seen in baseball, including the Yankees.
One of the stories of intrigue is about the manager, Don Mattingly. It was a lot like Dead Man Walking for a while, right. While there. Tell me the story behind that.
Well, so he sort of inherited the job. He came over from New York with Joe Torre. He was kind of his guy, and he was sort of the heir apparent to Torre. And he never had any managerial experience, and he was really raw. And not only that, but he never played in the National League. So a lot of the stuff, the managing in the National League is sort of like playing chess compared to American League of Checkers, because the American League, all you have to do is figure out what pitcher you're going to bring in. Very rarely are you subbing players in. Are you having to worry about, am I going to pinch hit? Am I going to double switch? All that, because pitchers don't hit. So there's way more strategy involved. And he really was quite frankly, he was in over his skis with a lot of that stuff, with the in-game management stuff. It just seemed like things were happening way too fast, and he was a step behind. Now, that being said, he is an exceptionally – it's really crazy to spend any time around him, because here is this Donnie Baseball, this legend, right, this guy who is, like, one of the more famous players of his generation. And he is, like, the most humble, chill, like – totally laid back guy and totally unimpressed with himself. You would never know if you saw him in a restaurant or a bar that he was like an icon. He still is. And he's just got a really easy way about him. And he's just great with people and managing egos. And that's what he did. So while he was sort of making gaffes late in games and, you know, double switches and all that, and fans were screaming about it, he was handling these pernicious egos behind the scenes. He was trying to figure out how to juggle four star outfielders for only three spots, and trying to figure out how am I going to get Puig to listen? What am I going to do? They all want to kill him, but we need him. And how am I going to, you know, how do I parent each one of these guys? And he did a fantastic job. And he's gotten better, actually, as a strategist. He's got a better bench coach now in Tim Wallace. And what I love about Don Mattingly is he's old school. He's from the 80s, and he's, you know, one of those toughest nails guys. But he's shown a willingness to listen to all of these saber, statistic-minded, you know, front office types. And that's it. Like, all you have to do is listen to that stuff. He wants it. He wants to combine his knowledge with their knowledge, which is so smart. And I think he's really a great complement to the front office they have at this point.
Molly, you know as well as I do that with championship teams, the leadership doesn't necessarily come from the general manager or even the manager. It comes out of the locker room. It's the players that determine that. And when they took on Yasiel Puig, I wondered how it was going to work. I mean, here was a young kid. He was a Cuban defector, and he did not mesh with the team. And you just pointed out that they wanted to kill him. Tell me the story about Matt Kemp and him almost coming to blows, and then what Zach Greinke did.
Yeah, so... It was just this weird, like, lightning in a bottle thing where it never happens that some kid, he should have spent more time in the minor leagues. He was so green. He had no, I mean, but he just had no business being in the majors, except that they were desperate. They needed him. They were in last place. And they had, this new ownership group did not want to rebuild. They had so many injuries. And so they called him up, like, okay, well, maybe we can call him up and see how this works. And he was just like, he had the best rookie month of anyone since Joe DiMaggio. It was insane. And everybody was just, like, sort of guilty of – I mean, everybody was acting stupid around him because what he was doing was stupid. You know, it was crazy. And he sort of right away got this sense, because he's very smart, he got the sense of, like, oh, yeah, I'm – I am saving the season here, and maybe I can show up when I want to show up. Maybe I can. It's sort of like a toddler can, a really smart kid can push your limits and test your boundaries and see exactly what he or she can get away with. That's what he did, and everybody from the players to the coaching staff to the front office, everyone was guilty of enabling at that point, and no one really cared because he was saving their season. And then, you know, fast forward to time marches on, and he's not that same guy who's got an OPS of 1,000 anymore, and the showing up late's getting old. The going into the locker room in between innings and when he's not hitting and playing on his phone and being the last person out to the field when the pitchers are already warming up. I mean, that was enrages them. And just different things like that just kind of get old. And it's not that he's done anything totally. Look, he's not a criminal. He doesn't do things that make him totally irredeemable. But as I've said to people, you know, I wanted to be fair to him in this book, and I think I'm fairly confident I was. But at the same time, you can't write a book about that locker room without talking about the impact that some of his behaviors had on his teammates.
What did he do to make Zach Greinke throw his bag out on Michigan Avenue in Chicago on a road trip?
Well, that was a whole other thing. I mean, basically, they wanted to, every year in Chicago, they have they do their rookie hazing where they make the guys dress up. And because the bus ride from O'Hare to the downtown hotel is like 40 minutes. And they wanted to make the kids go up to the front of the bus and sing and tell embarrassing stories, just cheesy stuff. Nothing like hazing. People hear hazing and they think like something bad, but no, just cheesy fun stuff. And Puig and some others were playing dominoes near the front of the bus and in the aisle, and they wouldn't move. They wouldn't let the rookies out to do their thing at the front of the bus with the microphone. So the veterans were upset. And then they finally, one of them had the idea that one of the people who was playing dominoes had the idea that they were just going to, we're going to park the bus and make the rookies go in and get us pizza. But at that point, the veterans, everybody else on the team was like, no, we played all day. We flew all night. We want to get back to the hotel. We're tired. Like, forget this. So Puig, who frequently does not wear, you're supposed to wear a suit with dress shoes on a plane and when you're traveling, and he frequently just wears flip-flops, and he realized he was going to be going into this restaurant, and so he wanted to look nice, so he opened the luggage bay to look for his bag to put his shoes on, and the players were telling the bus driver to go because they wanted to go back to the hotel. And the bus driver said, I can't move to the bus because someone's in the luggage bay, and you know, I the bus won't go with the bay is open. So they're yelling at him to hurry up, and he's taking his time, and Greinke, I love him. He basically gets a, you know, reputation maybe for being a jerk, but really he just sort of says what everybody else is thinking. So he got off the bus and helped Puig get his bag out of there, tossed it in the street and shut the bay and got back on the bus, and the bus went back to the hotel.
We only have a couple minutes left, and I would be amiss if I didn't get your perspective on Clayton Kershaw and the big contract, the richest ever in baseball.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, I was there. I happened to be there the day that it was totally done luck. I was in Dallas at his house sitting down for our extended sit-down interview for the book when he got the call that his deal was done. So it was an incredible stroke of luck that I was there. It was just the two of us in his house. His wife was out running errands. And he gets this phone call, and I hear his agent say, you know, congratulations, Clayton, the deal's done. And I'm watching. You know, he had an idea that it was just being finalized, but still, I'm watching this call, and he's smiling, and he's happy, and he's so like, wow, this is so cool. But then when it was over, he's like, okay, where were we? And I'm thinking, we got to get back to, you know, do you want to kick me out? Do you have somebody to call? Like, he's like, no, I want to do the interview. You're here. Let's do it. And it was just struck me, like, because I would have been so, I mean, I would have been, like, dancing, you know, in my backyard with a bottle of champagne or something. You know, I would have been. Like the rest of us doing cartwheels and whatever, calling everybody I know. He was just completely focused. And it was so crazy to realize in that moment, like, wow, I'm sitting across the table from a stone cold assassin. Like, this guy, he woke up in the morning. He knew he was doing the interview. It took him a long time. It took a while for me to get him to agree to it because he's very guarded, but he trusted me by the end of the season. He was gracious enough to invite me over, but there was nothing that was gonna stand in the way of him knocking that off his to-do list, not even this call telling me he was $250 million richer. That's the kind of person he is. And he feels an enormous pressure to live up to it. And I think, I hope that doesn't get in the way of baseball still being fun for him. I think he feels a duty. He feels he doesn't want to let the fans down or his teammates down. He puts an enormous amount of pressure on himself.
I want to thank you very much, Molly, for joining us. It's a fascinating book, and I urge people to check it out. It's called The Best Team Money Can Buy, The Los Angeles Dodgers' Wild Struggle to Build a Baseball Powerhouse. You're welcome here anytime. We're going to make it a selection of the month on the Sports Byline USA Book Corner. Thank you very much, Molly.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
This is a great book. If you're looking for a good inside story book about the Dodgers, I think you'll find it fascinating, not only from the way things work in baseball, but some of the personalities that this book gets into. You'll really like it. We continue across the country and around the world. I'm Ron Barr. We've got you on Sports Byline.